The alleged rape of an inmate raises questions about the safety of a Montana jail. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. We'll also tell you about the increasing avalanche danger, and in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a teacher from Sunburst Middle School about getting students interested in science and technology. The alleged rape of an undocumented immigrant is prompting his attorney to question how the Jefferson County Jail ensures the safety of prisoners. Mexican Odemio Orozco Ramirez says he was raped in the jail during the early morning hours of October 5th. He was undergoing deportation proceedings at the time. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says Jefferson County officials believe the jail provides adequate protection.
Audemio Orozco Ramirez says the rape happened the first night he was staying at the Jefferson County Jail. He had been detained a few days earlier after his immigration status was checked during a routine traffic stop. He says he woke up and several inmates from his cell pod were holding him down, and at least one was raping him. Orozco Ramirez's attorney, Shahed Hawk Hausrath, worries the Jefferson County Jail is not taking his client's accusations seriously.
A month after the sexual assault happened, they still hadn't interviewed each of the nine people who were in that detention cell with him.
He says DNA testing has still not been finished on Orozco Ramirez's clothing from that night. The alleged victim believes his clothes are contaminated with semen from his attacker. Also, Orozco Ramirez speaks little English, and Hawk Hausrath faults the jail for not making it easier for Orozco Ramirez to report the incident. He waited several days before he could talk with a Spanish-speaking official at an Idaho detention facility. Jefferson County Attorney Matthew Johnson says the jail is still awaiting reports on the evidence sent to the state crime lab.
Until they get us some final analysis and reports, we're still only able to say the case is being investigated.
Johnson says a lot of time has been put in tracking down those who were in the cell on the night of the alleged incident. He says even though there are no Spanish-speaking staff members at the jail, Orozco Ramirez did have access to a telephone.
If someone comes in the jail and they can't speak English, I think there's some effort made to ensure that, you know, there is adequate communication, access to attorneys, access to phone calls.
Johnson also says the jail's video surveillance system shows no evidence of the assault. There is a missing segment of video from about 2 a.m. to 4 a.m., but Johnson says that comes from the motion-activated camera shutting down during periods when no movement is detected. Hawk Hausrath says the footage starts again at 4 a.m. with someone coming out of a bathroom.
At some point, that person had to go into the bathroom. We don't believe that there was no footage, there's no motion during that time.
Johnson says the jail spent $5,000 having the video surveillance system checked in the wake of the Orozco Ramirez case.
The video system was working properly, and there has been no tampering with it.
Orozco Ramirez is now waiting in Sidney, Montana, to see if his case will go to trial. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, the Gallatin National Forest Avalanche Center has issued an avalanche warning for the backcountry of the Bridger Range and the northern Gallatin Range of southwestern Montana. Center officials said yesterday that more than 20 inches of snow has fallen over the last several days on an unstable snowpack. Additional stress on the snowpack has been caused by strong winds from the west to northwest. The center says the avalanche danger is high and travel is not recommended in the area. The warning lasts until tomorrow morning. A man and a woman were injured Saturday after being swept over a cliff in an avalanche while skiing out of bounds at Bridger Bowl. Authorities say the woman suffered a significant leg injury while the man suffered minor injuries. Butte Silver Bow County authorities say a 69-year-old man died in a single vehicle crash on Interstate 15. Coroner officials say Paul Pack of Alberta, Canada, crashed his semi-truck in the Moose Creek area yesterday morning. The Montana Highway Patrol says the truck was headed northbound on the interstate when it went off the roadway on a curve. The truck went over the median, over the frontage road, and struck an embankment. Parker died at the scene. The Montana Standard reports road conditions were wet and that alcohol and speed did not appear to be factors in the crash. If you waited till today to ship your Christmas presents, you already know you're cutting it close. But apparently, many people have waited till the last minute. Dave Chappie of the Shipping Depot in Missoula says he's seeing more last-minute shipments than ever this year. He has several tips for how to assure your packages arrive in good shape. First, make sure the box they're in is good and sturdy. Don't assume fragile items will be handled gingerly, and don't try to send items that might be classified as hazardous material.
Things like perfume have a very low flash point and are flammable, and they can only be shipped by ground. And at the shipping depot, we avoid flammable hazardous materials completely. So we disappoint customers when they want to ship perfume, for example. Things that are in spray cans, whether it's spray paint or silly string. Nope, can't do that.
Shapi also reminds people to be aware of items they are shipping could undergo extreme temperature changes en route to their destination. Tomorrow, during Montana Evening Edition, Shapi will talk about some of the more unusual items he's seen shipped over his nearly 30 years in the business. An environmental group wants a federal judge to halt a planned wolf and coyote derby in Idaho, branding the event an illegal killing contest. Filed today by Wild Earth Guardians and other groups, the complaint in U.S. District Court contends the U.S. Forest Service ignored federal laws when it okayed the derby scheduled for December 28th and 29th, without first securing a special use permit. A group behind the event aims to lure up to 300 hunters to Salmon, Idaho, to boost the economy and raise awareness for health concerns it says are related to wolves. The environmentalists say the Forest Service failed to follow its own procedures and violated the National Environmental Policy Act by, quote, failing entirely to consider the environmental impacts of allowing the killing contest, end quote. Federal wildlife officials have crafted a new plan to restore the highly endangered black-footed ferret that includes reintroducing the animal to more states. The prairie dog-eating member of the weasel family was thought to be extinct until 1981, when a rancher found a solitary enclave of the animals on northwest Wyoming. A U.S. Fish, Wildlife, and Service recovery plan released today calls for boosting their numbers to about 3,000 animals. That's versus about 500 black-footed ferrets in the wild today. Fish and Wildlife Service Black-footed Ferret Recovery Coordinator Pete Gober says the key element of this plan is to make it as non-threatening as possible to draw in more partners.
If we have purposeful prairie dog management and ferret management of only a small portion of what existed historically, this species can be recovered. But it can be threatening from a regulatory standpoint. The goals that we have are not mandatory and are not going to force anyone to do anything. We realize that if we don't have folks working together over the long term, we're not going to have the species out there.
The agency will work with private and public landowners to establish new populations across a 12-state historic range stretching from Texas to the Canadian border. Past recovery efforts were hampered by resistance from the agriculture industry and the disease that wiped out many prairie dog colonies that ferrets depend on. More with Pete Gober later on this week on Montana Evening Edition. A megaload of oil refinery equipment headed to Canada has arrived in Idaho. The 380-foot, 450-ton load left Vail, Oregon last night, traveled across the border, and was parked today at the junction of U.S. Highway 95 and Idaho Highway 55. It took 3 weeks for the load to travel 315 miles through Oregon. The Idaho Department of Transportation issued a permit Friday to Omega Morgan. It will be allowed to travel in Idaho only between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., and it will not be allowed to travel at all tonight through Wednesday night. The megaload is slated to travel 500 miles across Idaho, across into Montana on Highway 93, and head north to the tar sands of Alberta, Canada. We recently told you that Sunburst Middle School has won a $20,000 technology grant. The prize was part of a national project by Samsung to raise student awareness in science, technology, engineering, and math. Kim Block is a teacher in the school's gifted and talented program who helped obtain the grant. Sunburst is a Class C school situated along north central Montana's border with Canada, not far from the part of Sweetgrass. Block's husband is a local customs officer, and she was certified as a gifted and talented teacher in Georgia. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Block says they love their life in Montana, but admit it was a bit of a transition when they first moved here.
I grew up in Philadelphia, so that was, you know, having all the nightlife and the city and the traffic. Moving to Great Falls was a big change. One thing I realized after a couple months of living there, that I didn't hear traffic reports in the morning. It shocked me. And then moving from Great Falls to Sunburst was a big change. The biggest change is the fact that I can't order pizza. I wanted to order pizza.
Ooh, that'd be
so
tough.
So I have to become, yeah, I become a better chef.
And this time of year, especially what, week and a half ago or so, boy, it's got to be cold and windy.
It is very cold and very windy up here.
And that, in a way, is kind of connected to what we're talking about today. And I've heard about these alkali flats that apparently are kind of troublesome. What are these alkali flats?
Up here, and there's various places around the state. I think Billings has some of the same situations. But what happens is that alkali, which is a salt, somehow leaches through the ground and basically takes over an area. So we have an area up here that the alkali, the salt, has leached up through the ground and covers stretches of area. When it rains or when water covers the area, it's fine. But when the water evaporates, and this is what we're going to be finding out, in these areas, does the water go back into the ground? Does it seep back into the ground? Or is it just evaporating through, you know, the water cycle through evaporation and leaving behind the minerals? So that's what we need to find out. But we have big stretches of area that when the water evaporates, basically what you have left is a fine dust of salt, these minerals left on the ground. And it's fine unless the wind starts blowing. When the wind starts blowing, which is a very common occurrence up here, the alkali, which is now a fine dusty particles, start blowing with it. And with the winds and the way they blow off the Rockies, we have what you would consider in a snow whiteout condition. We've all driven in those in Montana. But it's worse than a snowstorm because if it gets in your mouth, you can't breathe either. So it's kind of dangerous on that for rescue workers and people that have to come if there is an accident. The other problem with the alkali is, as I said, it takes over the area. So agriculture is huge for all of us in Montana. So farmers are constantly battling this problem in their fields. So it really can be an issue.
And it's led also to some terrible automobile accidents that have hit very close to home for your district.
Yeah, it was pretty sad last May. The winds were blowing, and just remember being up on the football field and looking down over the highway, and it's like you could see it. It's just really weird. Later that afternoon, because of these whiteout conditions and where we are so close to the Port of Sweetgrass and the Highway 15 that runs through, we have just a multitude of cars and trucks, 18-wheelers that come into the country through that port. And unfortunately, on that day in May, it was one of those days, and our speech pathologist was driving home from school that day, and unfortunately, there was a large chain reaction car accident in which, unfortunately, she had passed away during that time. I believe she ran into a truck that had stopped, and then it was just a chain reaction of car accidents. And then, as I was talking about, the rescue workers that came up to take care of the accident were in accidents. Our golf team, four of our high school boys and the assistant golf coach was in the accident. And I mean, thank God nothing major happened in that situation. I mean, the boys were hurt. The car was destroyed. And it was a horrible day for Sunburst. And that is what got me thinking when we got to this Samsung Technology Solve for Tomorrow contest. That day stuck in my mind.
Your superintendent announced that Samsung was going to come in with this technology grant competition. It's called Solve for Tomorrow. You, Ms. Block, you put two and two together and said maybe something can happen here.
Right. Kim Clark, the superintendent, she sent out the email to the staff saying, hey, here's a STEM contest. STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math, something that I have been involved in trying to bring to any of my students in any of the classes. You know, how do we bring science, technology, engineering, and math to the students? And what Samsung put out is, how can you interest your students? How are you going to engage your students in the STEM process? And so in thinking about what happened in May and thinking about the agricultural situation up here, I just thought, well, I know what would really engage these kids and, you know, give them an opportunity to make a difference and solve a problem. And so I wrote about that. I had to answer three questions. You know, how would you engage the kids? What community problem could you solve? And what are your technology needs? So in 100 words or less, for each of those three questions, I put together a plan that would engage the kids in using science, in using technology, in using engineering and math, and the community problem we could solve. That was in September, the end of September. And then in November, we were notified that we were one of the top five in the state for the contest. From that day, November 5th, I had to write a three-page lesson plan on what activities the kids would do to complete this project. You know, it's always a team effort in utilizing the eighth grade and the seventh grade and the fifth grade teachers, and I'm putting my lesson plan together and asking everyone to look at it and see what they thought, and I submitted it. And I think December 6th or 7th, we were notified that we were the state winner for the Samsung Solve for Tomorrow contest.
Wow. You used the phrase, make a difference, solve a problem. So what is the plan? How can kids get involved in this? This sounds like heavy-duty problem solving.
It is, and it is going to be it's going to be exciting. It's going to be challenging. It's going to be frustrating. But our first steps is, and we are really excited. We have been in contact with our local water and soil experts. We're in contact with our county experts. We are talking to seismographic companies that have been working out here. So we are lining up all of these wonderful experts to come in and work with the kids and talk about the geology of the area first, and figure out why we have this alkali problem that we have. From that, the kids are going to be studying and creating topographic maps. And from those topographic maps, the kids are going to, this is going to be probably the most challenging part, is making models, scale models from the topographic maps to recreate the alkali flat area. We are going to recreate with models the alkali flats, and then the kids are going to start applying solutions that they have come up with. And those solutions are going to be anywhere from different plants they've learned from the salinity expert that the kids are going to talk to that might be able to grow there, to somehow trying to keep the area wet all the time. Is that going to work? There's just so many variables that the kids will be working with to try to come up with a solution. And it's going to be a trial and error. It's going to be a lot of trial and error. And that's what science, that's what investigation is all about. From that point, you know, hopefully we'll come up with a suggestion or solution. I'll present it to the town council. Then we're going to present it to the county commissioners. And we'll see what happens. Hopefully we can make a difference.
What an opportunity here. This $20,000, what does it mean to, and last question, what does this mean to Sunburst Middle School's technology infrastructure?
Oh, it's going to be wonderful. It means more technology in the hands of the kids. The latest, the greatest, more technology. So we have technology where a class at a time can use it, but this might mean that every student can have hands-on technology at any time. That's really exciting. Not only do we get to possibly solve a problem, but we possibly will be able to get even more technology. So it's just a win-win.
Kim Block, Sunburst Middle School's gifted and talented education teacher. Congratulations. Good work. And keep us posted on how this goes, would you?
Thank you. Yes, I will. Thank you very much.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 a.m. tomorrow for the West Glacier region, the Lower Clark Fork region, the Bitterroot Sapphire Mountains, the Potomac Sealy Lake region. And tonight, rain is likely with areas of snow and lows in the 20s. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow and highs in the upper 20s and mid-30s. For central Montana, there's a high wind warning in effect until 11 o'clock tonight for the Rocky Mountain Front. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain in the evening and a chance of snow through the night. Lows in the 20s with west winds with possible gusts up to 65 miles per hour along the Rocky Mountain Front. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow and highs in the 30s. West winds could also be gusting up to 40 miles per hour in the afternoon. For southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies and a chance of rain in the evening and a chance of snow through the night with lows 15 to 25 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour through the canyons and passes. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies and a slight chance of snow with highs 25 to 35 degrees. And for our current listening area, Helena is 27 degrees with clear conditions. In Kalispell, it's cloudy and 35 degrees. Butte has 41 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Great Falls is fair with 43 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature under cloudy skies is 36 degrees. It's 40 degrees and mostly cloudy in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's cloudy and 40 degrees. Libby has 36 degrees with light rain. And in Polson, skies are cloudy and it's 38 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Bruce Farling.
When Senator John Tester's Forest Jobs and Recreation Act, or FJRA, passed a key Senate committee this week, sending the measure to the Senate floor, it marked only the second time in 25 years that a major piece of Montana-based federal legislation with wildland protection has moved in Congress. The other instance was last month's positive committee vote on Senator Baucus's Rocky Mountain Front Heritage Act. FJRA continues to move through Congress despite opponents, including some lawmakers and reporters, mischaracterizing what the bill is meant to achieve. The critics claim the bill simply trades wilderness protection for logging. That's incorrect. There is what the bill is and what they want it to be. FJRA is more than 50 pages long, and there is a reason for this. Though a primary objective is to permanently protect deserving fish and wildlife habitat and recreational areas on one forest, the Beaverhead Deer Lodge, and two ranger districts on the Kootenai and Lolo National Forests, it also creates a tool chest that the Forest Service can tap to restore habitats on previously eroded and logged landscapes, while requiring the agency to apply improved protective standards than currently whenever it cuts trees. At least one Montana Daily reporter continues to reflexively parrot the claims of a small handful of environmental opponents by reporting that FJRA aims to develop roadless wild country. It does no such thing. Nothing in the bill orders the Forest Service to develop an acre of its roadless land inventory, much to the dismay of some development-minded opponents. The same environmental naysayers hyperventilate over the bill's directive on forest management. They claim it is destructive by mandating logging on 100,000 acres of the three forests in the next 15 years. They conjure the large destructive clearcuts of the past. But that's not what the bill will do. The measure doesn't even mention logging. For instance, it directs the agency in its own parlance to treat less than 2% of the 3.3 million acre Beaverhead Deer Lodge National Forest in a series of projects that include habitat restoration over 15 years. That is hardly large-scale devastation, and it doesn't necessitate going into low productivity roadless lands. The bill's language is clear that the treat requirement does not mean producing vast swaths of commercial logging. Instead, it contemplates using a wide spectrum of activities that remove trees, including, yes, some commercial logging, but also thinning that produces wood for many uses, including energy generation, removal of fire-prone fuels around communities, removal of insect-infested stands in developed areas, commercial firewood cutting, Christmas tree removal, harvest of small trees for fence materials, and other activities, many of minimum impact and either directly or indirectly could produce a commercial product. Importantly, the bill doesn't order the agency to produce a set amount of board feet, harvested trees, or tons of wood, nor does it dictate the intensity of tree removal that could occur in a project. Every venture will still trigger environmental reviews, public participation, and screening through existing environmental laws. To engender consensus, FJRA further requires the Forest Service to develop projects in partnership with citizen committees comprised of conservation and development interests. Critically, the bill specifically directs the agency to focus tree harvest not on undeveloped areas, but on previously logged and roaded areas or sites where fire might threaten a community. FJRA also directs that revenue from projects be reinvested on the affected forest to fix damaged habitat. This can eliminate roads that fragment wildlife habitat or a bleeding sediment into trout streams. The revenue can also fund weed control or improvements of recreational facilities and trails. The tree harvest elements of FJRA are modest. Still, protection from potential harm is bolstered by other bill requirements, including a mandate that the Forest Service maintain streamside buffers that are as good or better than at present, and that after project completion, road networks must be reduced to meet scientifically based standards for wildlife protection. Projects sprinting from the bill will reduce harmful roads, help ensure fiber is produced for local mills, and create habitat and recreational values that exceed pre-project conditions. FJRA protects the best wildlands, helps create jobs, and aims to fix damaged landscapes. Now, what's so wrong with that? This is Bruce Farling of Montana Trout Unlimited. Happy holidays, and have an environmentally helpful 2014.
Bruce Farling is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.